quarter.
We got word that some of the speakers will be coming about 4:30.
Perfect. Okay, well, we're going to begin this meeting. This is the meeting of the House Sustainable Task Force, and I am Representative Tammy Wilson, and with me is Representative Lynn Gaddis. And we are here today to have a town hall meeting and with the Kodiak folks. And there also our call-in numbers. If people were unable to make it, they are more than welcome to call in, and we will have you up pretty much in the order as we have them listed. And we will get the number to you, and we will broadcast that as soon as they do. And I know it's on our sheet of paper, so I'm sure we'll get through. Oh, we have it right here because they gave it to us. So if you want to testify telephonically, you can call 907-463-5009 or toll-free at 855-463-5009. So whatever is the most convenient for people. We know that for some teachers that they may still be in the classroom. I know when I taught, there was long hours because you were still making up the next day's paperwork and grading the things that came in. So either one is great. So with that, we're going to go ahead and start and with Norm Wooten, who is part of the Association of Alaska School Boards. Welcome, Norm.
Thank you. For the record, I am Norm Wooten, and I'm the Director of Governmental Relations with the Association of Alaska School Boards. I'm a local school board member as well, so I live, breathe, and eat this this stuff all the time. One of the our board of directors put together their priorities immediately after our annual conference in November in Anchorage, and one of those broad priorities that encompass all of our resolutions package is protecting the classroom, and that covers a lot of different things among those funding. Right now, districts across the state are having a lot of stressors that take place in the classroom. Among those are aligning the curriculum to the new Alaska content standards. Along with that, the professional development for our paraprofessionals and our teachers that work with youngsters in the classroom, as well as the new teacher evaluations that are going on. All of these things, we in the association, we believe in standards. We believe in rigorous standards. And we think that our standards ought to continually become more rigorous so that students are prepared when they graduate from high school. We embrace that all the way. But those are not cheap. They don't come at no cost. And so we're having to pay for those. And all of our districts are feeling that right now. Let me say that we appreciate all of our districts, all of us appreciate the additional funding that the legislature has put into our classroom. But let me put the caveat on there. When it's categorical funding, it doesn't always trickle down to the classroom. A case in point is the safety and security funding that came in last year. Certainly, we want our classrooms and our facilities to be safe. Certainly, we want cameras, these new locks, all the things that go with safety and security. But if our districts had to choose between putting those in right now or putting money into the classroom, I suspect that most districts would choose to put it into the classroom. And so categorical funding is not always the best way. It's disturbing when the legislature views or has a reluctance to put additional funding into the formula. And the formula was created by the legislature to equitably distribute education dollars to school districts. And so I would just ask that you think about that when you look at education. All school districts are feeling the crunch right now. All you have to do is read the Anchorage Daily News, which you do, and read about the plight of the Anchorage School District. Well, that is occurring everywhere in the state as we try to make the dollars that we have go somewhere that does the most good for kids. I want to thank you for your work with the legislative work that you do and the willingness of your committee to spend the time in the interim to address the educational needs of our students. We recognize the time that it takes, and we appreciate the effort, and these remarks are given with the utmost respect for what you do. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? You don't have to, just asking.
No, I don't. I guess I look at some of these things and I look at more of a statement, and I hear you when you talk about the categorical funding, and in this particular case, us talking about safety things. It's the formula funding. If you look into it, you could see that it should encompass many other things that, unfortunately or fortunately, and I would say fortunately as an ex-school board member, that we are paying outside of the formula. So somehow or another, that formula that was supposed to cover all these things, it in itself either is not. And so I think the bigger thing is looking at what it should and shouldn't cover and what we're either doing right, different, how we can make efficiencies. I'm not advocating for spending the next, I don't know, 20 days opening up the BSA, because I think it's a bigger subject than that, and it'll take more time, and there are unintended consequences by not doing it correctly. But I hear you.
And I don't want to appear to be ungrateful for the funding that you've given
right.
us. I meant
right.
this in the most with the utmost respect, and we are willing to be partners at any time in looking at cost savings that are outside the classroom. Okay, and so we ought to school on the record saying that.
And it's the formula, not the BSA, that we would be opening up. And I'm sorry.
It's become such a sore subject
and
because
with,
people do speak BSA, 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 and you hear it all over the place.
Sure.
And we did make a commitment not to refer to it as the BSA, but as the formula, because it's bigger than that. So
you'll notice that I referred to it.
And you did, and we did notice that.
And
I stand corrected, so thank you.
Yeah, and it will take a longer look at the formula. That is something that will probably be a recommendation that we're looking at, because within the formula is the BSA, the per student, but also there's where the community is, the size of the school. There's some rules that are in there that made sense probably many years ago as maybe a smaller school costs more than a larger school, but now that we're starting the digital world, you know, it doesn't matter whether I have 300 kids in a school or 20, those devices cost a lot to, not just for the device, but also for the internet. And so I do believe that as we start shifting some of our gears, but right now, you know, I know for me, it's looking at the standards, the curriculum, and then what testing we may be utilizing and how to have all that in place in 2015, which is something I think we have been spending days, if not weeks, on discussing, because the department RFP has ended now for the testing.
Yes.
And they're going to be looking at that, and it has to be a determination by the legislature whether or not they feel that this belongs to the department to decide, mm-hmm. or whether or not this needs to be decided legislatively, especially because it will take teacher development. It will take different curriculum in some cases, or at least enhancement to curriculum that is there, and I don't think we have a very good picture at this point in time on what those costs are. But we would appreciate that if different districts do have an idea of how much those costs may be, you know, whether or not they feel they have to buy entirely new curriculum or they think they could supplement, that would be very helpful on our portions of it, because, as you know, we have 53 school districts, all of them, you know, using different curriculum. Some just bought some on a six-year plan. That's kind of what Fairbanks is, trying to buy new, and others just supplement. So if they have some cost on those, that would be very helpful.
I made a note of that. Yes.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much for taking time.
Thank you.
And the next with us is Stuart McDonald. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. I'm Stuart McDonald, superintendent of school. I started off as a special education teacher 21 years ago. I've taught elementary, middle school, and high school. Started right here in Kodiak. I've worked many different positions, and I am now the superintendent of schools here. This is my sixth year. And I have been watching education like many of you have, and all of the changes and trends in it to improve things for students. I very much thank this particular legislature for taking on the question of sustainable educational funding. That is critical. I wanted to address a few simple steps. One of our wonderful, esteemed colleagues and educators just came in. I think we're going to have several teachers come in here soon. Education is an investment. This is about the study of not just the economics of education, sustainable education funding, but it is at the heart of all of our sustainable economy. A 25-year investment before a profit can be seen is what it takes out of a student. So a student is a 25-year investment before you can actually measure a profit. You measure a profit in a student by at least a 30-year career of a contribution. That contribution can be measured in part by an earned income, tax revenue generated, as well as other less monetary contributions. The economics of education is complex and requires a long-range plan and long-range funding. That's simple. We're caught in a loop right now of annual short-term planning, annual short-term funding. Cutting costs unto itself is not a plan. Setting long-range targets and providing adequate investment in staffing, training, materials, activities, and technology will produce accountable results. Quick fixes, fast turnarounds, these will not create sustainable results. I was just thinking about the previous testimony and some of the things that we were discussing. In 2009, I started off as superintendent with 476 employees. I was asked to find efficiencies. We had budget issues and trying to keep up with the cost of all of the things that we needed to do. We found ways to cut costs and deal with what we needed to deal with. We have 390 employees today, 390 people doing the work that previously was 476 employees. They were not surplus people. We have people here in this room that are being shared between two buildings, and it's exhausting, and hope you'll speak to that, that we're finding every efficiency we can to make this work. Test scores are not our only indicator. You're going to hear a lot of you're talking about Common Core equivalent or better, like our new Alaska State standards are, that we're measuring. We have, and I hope everybody does understand, more than English language arts and mathematics, we've adopted a process of evaluation of teachers and administrators that requires a measurement of those non-tested subjects, PE, social studies, culinary arts, and we are having to come up with common assessments and measurements for the content standards for everything, come up with measurement targets to actually assess the growth in students in everything taught as this whole package. So when we talk about materials and supplies and training, it goes beyond English, language arts, and mathematics. Other indicators that we work on are things as simple as suicide prevention, a significant issue in this state. Kodiak has been aggressively engaging suicide prevention measures. This is something I don't take lightly, and it's awkward to mention because there's something a little distasteful for this kind of dialogue and celebration. We celebrate our kids living, and we are now on our fifth year of not having any student successful suicides island-wide in this district when we have had several a year prior to that. This takes time, staff commitment, money, training, dedication. It takes people. We're a people business. Please create a funding mechanism that pays for the people, the training, the materials, the activities, and the technology. Our students need to be successful contributors so that when they have their 30-plus years to contribute and earn that income and raise those tax revenues, that they are building a sustainable economic future for Alaska and this country. And it's a long-term commitment. Thank you very much.
Can you repeat the, you had training, the last part you did, to fund the funding mechanism, everything you had.
To train the people. We're a people business.
Right.
Training the materials.
Okay,
so
I'm just trying to write down. I couldn't
activities. And technology. Let me just, if you don't mind, take a second longer on speaking to the idea of activities. You can put a student in a room in front of a computer. You could teach them the basic ways to pass a test and get some basic rudimentary education through distance or through the computer. No student becomes a productive person without actually translating that into activity. Career and technology education, student sports, enrichment, you name it. These are the things that actually build us as people. And it's all a part of the education system, and there are more research documents that support a student's involvement and engagement and activity as a better predictor of their future than the test score. So funding it all matters.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You know, I have a question for the superintendent while he's still here, and again about the funding. And I'm not necessarily advocating, but I'm asking – I suspect that you network with other superintendents, so you may have some insight or something in regards to this. So back to the funding, and you're certainly not the first person that's had the discussion.
Right.
And I don't think all the discussions have been surrounded around we just need more funding, but we need constant, we need to know where it's coming from, we need to be able to count on it, and certainly that's a portion of the funding. The other portion is just food for thought, and I'd like to hear just off the cuff, not much thing. And so I realize I'm putting you on the spot, and there's no real right or wrong answer. But
I'm ready.
Okay, here we go. What kind of incentive pay, or would that work? Now, as we look out in the – I don't like to imply that teaching is not the real world, because I was raised by teachers, and it was my real world.
Mm-hmm.
So, but with that being said, there are in other industries and other jobs where people will pay a base pay and then incentivize. Is there a place as we look at funding and how to create incentives? I personally don't like the stick method where we have disincentives. I really like the reward part where people can reach as far as they possibly can. I believe that there are some people that are truly rock stars in this business. I believe that there are people that are pretty darn good, and I believe that there are people that are good that will strive to attain rock star status. So as we know that there are levels, whether it be a basketball player, whether I go on and on,
right.
How can we in this industry incentivize and bring out that specialness that I think that there are many teachers that have?
We've heard many commentaries on this topic, and so what I'm going to do is try and avoid some of the things that you've probably heard over and over again. I would like to initially contrast what I'm going to say with the inverse. There's a decentive. Every single budget cycle, we go through a demotivating experience. We go through a process to where we have a funding mechanism that first off makes us project, if we change nothing, what's our rollover cost? We are anticipating a funding revenue that's short, so we have to start every year in January with this deficit, this difference, where we have to entertain cuts. So while teachers are in the middle of the highest, mm-hmm. most engaged season
mm-hmm.
of teaching, getting kids ready for that state test, working with kids, they have to also endure a budget session that talks about how their jobs are in jeopardy, who's there, if they're not senior enough or tenured, could they be pink slipped or not, and how do we make that go, and people have to vie for the validity and preservation of what they do in the middle of trying to do their job. There's no greater decentive that can take place. It's a demoralizing experience every single year. While that's our backdrop, you've heard people say, well, if if you just paid me a little bit more money, maybe I'll get out there and actually teach this time and actually reach those kids. It's kind of an insulting concept because our teachers, in fact, are. I've yet to meet a teacher that isn't doing what they know how to do and trying to do it. So most teachers that are not performing at the level that they'd like to, it isn't because they don't want to or that you're not giving them that carrot to just pay me a little bit more, I would do it. It's that they don't have access to that training. So now here comes that pay, that incentive pay that you're talking about. Incentive pay is making training available so that as teachers become more proficient, better skilled at their craft, they're paid for it. Right now, teachers have to do that on their own terms in the summer. A teacher during the summer has to extend their education on their own. Mm-hmm. A district either has to pull them out of a classroom from their teaching to actually give them additional training away from students, losing student instructional time, or we have to come up with some mechanism and a shrinking budget to try and pay them some pittance of what their actual hourly rate might be to do some training outside of that day, which we don't have a lot, or they do it on their own. So coming up with ways to reward teachers in pay to continue that study and get better. Now, we already have some of that mechanism in place with that salary schedule, but it's worth a conversation, worth a study. But in the past, there have been mechanisms put in place that says if your students perform at this level, you get more pay. But the complexity of what that looks like turns into something that gets really strange. The economics of student performance then becomes a distraction and a high-stakes thing, and kids don't all show up one size fits all, and it's a very complex topic.
Right.
I think that the biggest bang for the buck in terms of incentive pay is being able to pay teachers for their skill set and acquiring that skill set and making it go.
I hear you. And I know that there are other people, so we'll move on. I wasn't necessarily thinking of the financial part. That certainly counts. But what – and just food for thought – you know, if somebody is meeting or exceeding, would we give them more freedom? Would we, you know, just a thought. So you know, I mean,
like
I don't want to belabor this.
Academic freedom,
sure.
Curricular freedom,
yeah.
Those kinds of things,
yeah.
Certainly things to consider.
Yeah. Anyway.
Rewarding good work is always important.
There you go. Thank you.
Could you just tell me what year you came?
1992.
Thank you. I want to check the numbers of students. So that's perfect. So we have Deborah Kirk.
I'm a school member. Do you want to hear from the teachers first? Or I'm not going to be long, but.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Sure.
Okay. That's fine. Would
thanks
you
for. For thank
okay.
you.
Okay. Eric.
Walton.
There you go. Come on up. And we should put out that we had planned to stay a few, you know, a bit longer after this meeting. If we have any teachers that would like to chit-chat afterwards off the record, we're certainly fine with that. So for those that may want to.
Okay, with that, thank you, Eric, for being here. If you could just say your name for the record and here to listen.
Okay. My name is Eric Walsenbach. I teach at Kodiak Middle School and Kodiak High School.
Okay.
I was up all night last night with two sick boys, and I got up at 5 to come in and do lesson plans, but I passed them off to my wife because I think this is important that you hear some information
thank
from
you.
Us. So I was just recently, this week, listening to NPR, and there was a study that was just put out. I don't know if you heard about
mm-hmm.
it, the International Testing Program for International Student Assessment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm sure then you're aware of the results that we're stagnating. Many other countries are improving. And so I started looking at that and applying it to our district, our state, and I started to think about all the things that we're doing at the state level that's totally counter to what was presented in that study. So I just want to give you some firsthand knowledge of how the flat funding has impacted my classroom, my students, because that's my perspective. Our district's done a number of things to deal with the budget cuts, including moving from a 6-period day to a 7-period day, which calculates out to about 5.3 weeks less of instruction per class over the course of a 9-month period. You're losing over a month of time to instruct per class. My class size has gone up from seeing about 89 students last year to 138. So you're getting like a third again as many students in a compressed amount of time. And then, as Mr. McDonald mentioned, one of the other cost-cutting measures is to share staff between middle school and high school, which I am one of those people, and it creates a whole host of inefficiencies, one of which is lack of access to students, students' lack of access to me during the day, parent-teacher conferences, can't be at both places at the same time. So, and there's a long list of inefficiencies that go along with that, but as I looked at this study and saw, well, what are those other countries like Vietnam and third world nations doing to become better than us in reading, writing, math, and science? They've been working to provide more resources for kids who are harder to educate. And if you look at what we've done over the last few years, we're the exact opposite. When I taught at the middle school before I moved to the high school, we had, well, the district has had to cut reading specialists at the elementary level, English as second language support across the board, K-12. At the high school, we used to have low-level classes for ninth graders who needed extra support in English. Those are gone this year. So we are sort of gutting the very things that are creating gains in other countries. Low-level classes at the middle school are gone. I actually, when I first moved to the middle school, I taught students who were not proficient. They weren't served by special ed. Here's a need. We need to support these students. And now, as I go back to the middle school, those are all gone, and now we have advanced classes for all students, 6-8, but no low-level classes. So we're sort of waging an all-out attack on those students that are the hardest to educate.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I'm just trying to understand. So in the middle school, for subjects you're talking about has advanced students. Can you tell me, like, what class, just so I can understand what you had before?
I teach English, so I teach a section of advanced eighth grade English.
Okay.
And there are advanced English classes at each level. There's advanced science classes at each level.
And then you used to have the opposite on the other end, and then kind of that middle group that you.
Right.
And now you have the advanced in the middle.
Well,
everybody's in the middle now.
And it's the same way at the high school. I teach an honors class at the ninth grade, but now I don't have the option to move students who can't access the material into a class that actually supports their needs. Okay. So those are gone. So how that impacts my instruction and all of my students, with the exception of the honor students, is I have students in my regular classes that are reading at a third and fourth grade level. I have very bright second language students that can't access the language, but they don't have a second language program to support their needs. So they're all in one. And so if I plan a lesson that, and I have advanced students in my regular classes too, so if I plan a lesson that supports the students who, you know, can't read at but a third or fourth grade level, I lose 3/4 of my class. If I plan a lesson for the upper third, I lose the bottom half. If I plan a lesson in the middle, so no matter what I do, short of planning 3 lessons and using completely different materials, my effectiveness is going down the toilet, basically. I feel the least effective that I have been in my 15 years of teaching.
And I have kind of a silly question, and I really just don't know the answer. I'm not trying to be nasty.
Mm-hmm.
What would keep you from, and this sounds like, but why can't you teach three different classes at the same time? Now, I'm not saying that you're Superman and all that kind of stuff. Here's where I'm coming from, and this is why I asked the question. So, and I'm not a teacher, so I don't understand. I think this is important to know.
Yeah.
I come from a two-room schoolhouse where the teacher did teach first, second, third, fourth grade,
mm-hmm.
and then fifth through eighth in the other room.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was able to teach four classes, not at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I have seven younger brothers, and we've all gone through, and it's all been in Alaska, in the middle of nowhere, whatever. We're fortunate we had parents that were college educated and what, so on and so forth. So, you know, I know that that plays into it.
Sure.
But we still kind of chuckle about, and it was a few years ago that I might have gone to at first grade. But the technology then was these things called earphones and these reel-to-reels. And the teacher would put that on, first graders listen and read the words out loud while she taught second grade, third. And I don't remember all of the tricks because I was just a kid then.
Mm-hmm.
But so using that background, that's why I asked the question. So, I mean, please help me. I really don't know.
Sure. Differentiation, which is what you're talking about, is an important concept in education because clearly not every student's going to be at the
mm-hmm.
same position. But there's only a certain range in which you can differentiate. So you have a student, I mean, believe me, I think I speak for a number of teachers that say they're doing the best they can.
I believe that, yeah.
And, like, for instance, right now, we're reading Homer's Odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
I have a graphic novel version that I copy off and give to the students that have a hard time accessing the material. Well, that's not going to capture everybody. And if you're talking about effective instruction, you're talking about student achievement, those students are not going to get their needs met just by having the graphic novel version of the Odyssey to read. Yeah, they might be able to get the story, but are they really getting the language that they need, the sentence structure, the grammar, the basic building blocks of the language?
On that particular grade level.
They're not. I continue to go back to providing resources for those who are the hardest to educate. By throwing students into a mix, you're not providing resources to support those students' achievement, and you're diminishing the achievement of every student in that class. So, yes, differentiation is important. No, it can't be done outside of a certain range.
Do you know, because, you know, what we're trying mm-hmm. to figure out by the state testing that's currently mm-hmm. done and how much is it actually, utilized, especially all the way down to the student portion of that. Do you know within the middle school, you know, like for, let's say for like 7th grade math,
mm-hmm.
you know, do they, does your district right now kind of do some of that for you now, so maybe you don't have a lower and a middle and upper, but to where you at least close the gap a little bit, or is it just this 20 or 30 or whatever goes into this class and this 30 goes
sure.
in there?
I'm not sure how the decisions are being made.
Okay. And I know, in fact, we always go back to what we had in school.
Sure.
And, you know, and what we were, you know, I had schools where everybody was just, you just got the class,
mm-hmm.
and whatever the draw was is what you have. And I've been part of a school where at the 5th grade they had different reading classes. We all took some kind of test that they... And they weren't always accurate
right.
either, let me tell you. There was people where they didn't belong, but at least
right.
it closed the gap a little bit.
Well, yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the idea of closing the gap because my wife's a first grade teacher, and she's also a reading specialist, but she doesn't work in the capacity of a reading specialist outside of her classroom, obviously, but we lost all our reading specialists. So last year, and every year before that, she's been able to support those students at first grade. When you talk about a gap, you know, seeing a gap and then closing it early or giving them the support, like she'd have students go with a reading specialist for, I don't know, an hour a day. They'd go work at their level to remediate some of those skills that they're not developing as quickly. Well, there's pretty strong research that shows at that age, if you address that, then they have a much better chance of saying, well, now she has all her students in a first grade classroom with, you know, similar issues that I have. They're not getting the support they need, so all of her time or the majority of her time is helping them, so everybody else doesn't get her attention. So I think I want you to see, like, the severity and the systemic nature of this problem, because if you, like, we're only beginning to feel the effects of flat funding and really cutting, because when those first graders get to my classroom in ninth grade, you can imagine the gap that's going to be created. So when we talk about investing in education, right now you're basically, like, stripping away every support that we know works. Like, by the way, when I was at the middle school with those low-level courses, well, I started out with a full day of them, and by 3 or 4 years, there was only one section left because it actually worked, and now they're gone. So we don't have the support, I guess. And if I go back to this, the good news is that Massachusetts, you know, they singled out Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Well, you can do something about it. Mm-hmm. That state has. And they did it by raising standards, providing greater support, and investing deeply in the quality of their teachers. And I think it's pretty clear that just by raising standards alone, you're not going to increase student achievement or have stronger accountability. Yeah, standards are good. They're important. But if that's the only leg you stand on and you don't support greater support for teachers and you don't invest deeply in the quality of the teachers with professional development, you got a one-legged stool, and students aren't going to be able to sit at the future international table without that foundation of those three things. And we're going backwards in two of them, and we're shooting standards through the roof. So, mm-hmm. you know, you talk about incentive pay. You can offer anybody the money they want, however much money you want. They're not going to be able to do it without the support for their students and the quality of professional development they need to make it
happen. And I might mention, when I said pay, I meant incentive of some sort, not necessarily
right.
a pay. Because, and maybe one of those incentives are some of the things that you just spoke about. So, I mean, thank goodness that they're, I mean, I hear where you're coming
right.
from. I'm not leaving anything off the table on
right.
this task force. And that's really why we're asking these questions. Doesn't mean we're going down these, but I mean, I appreciate you folks coming forth and really being honest and being kind of part of the helping fix the problem. You guys work, you're there every day in it. We kind of look at it from a higher level down. And so I'm hoping that we can all kind of put our thoughts together and really work well together to make it work. Because I don't think that I see in the legislature that people want to make school districts not work. I think the challenge is when you talk to your constituents or folks in our towns see things differently than possibly teachers, and that's that information, and how do we work together and make it work?
Well, I'm glad you're taking the time to learn about this. And
yeah, thanks for inviting us, by the way.
Yeah. And I want to caution you about incentive pay, because every teacher needs support for all their students. Those are systemic things. Like, that's not an incentive. We all need that to do our
mm-hmm.
jobs effectively. And I do feel like it is a slap in the face to me to offer some incentive for me to do better, because it implies that I'm not doing the best I can with what I have. Now, give me the support I need, and then you'll see the achievement you want. But, you know, every system is perfectly tuned for the output that it gets. So if you don't change what's going on in the system, like providing more support, you know, you're going to continue to get that outcome, and I think we've realized that with the educational reforms in the United States after we see this report where it's just hasn't changed. So, but there, I think it's important to look at examples where it has worked, Massachusetts being one. You know, they've stayed the course for decades. They've protected the support for their classrooms where they need it. They've invested in, you know, the quality of their teachers. And, you know, you look at the facts of my position, and I know I'm not unique across the state. You know, I've got a third more students. I have 5.5 weeks less time to teach what I have to teach, and 5.5 weeks less of my own collaboration time and planning time to put together lessons. And I don't have support for second language learners, any student who's struggling in any way, or reading specialists throughout the system. So, you know, you've cut off two legs, and we're just holding up standards and thinking that's going to do it. But, you know, it looks like it's pretty clear what we need to do, and I'm just here to sort of put a face to the problems and help you see the really major challenges that, you know, like Mr. McDonald said, there's no extra fat out there. There's no – all those teachers that are gone, like, they're not doing the job that they did before, and we're all suffering for it.
And so, you know, we are researching Massachusetts. Our office has had – my office has had a lot of conversation with them and have pulled information off of what they're doing now and where they've gone and how they've gone there. So we have actually looked at a lot of different states trying to see what, you know, worked there and how we could bring it here. Well, we appreciate very much what you do, and thank you so much for taking your time to come today.
And actually, I have one more question. Since he's in the trenches, I'm going to give you one more.
Sure.
And that is, there's a bill out there that talks about retaining kids if they can't read at third grade level or third grade proficiency. Thoughts on that? I mean, because you brought up the fact that you have kids that maybe can't read on level, and I just want to hear what the trenches have to say.
Okay. Well, we know that if we retain a student for 1 year, they're 50% less chance that they're going to graduate. And if we retain them 2 years, that percentage goes up. I was in – my first 3 years in this state were in Dutch Harbor, and there was a group of seventh-grade boys who, you know, weren't learning, weren't performing, and the community said, we're going to retain. And so they didn't retain – they retained them that year, and they stayed in seventh grade, and then a group of sixth-grade boys came and joined them, and there was a huge mass of them, and then they said, oh, we can't do this, and then they passed them all along again. So I don't think retention is the answer. I think the answer is providing programs that actually support their needs so that they can learn to read.
And I think here was my question. I get you in the seventh grade, and I get you when you talk about the sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
But if we go back down and we go, because anybody that has, and I've worked in classrooms where I've helped fifth or sixth grade boys, no offense to your males, but you're a little bit tougher nut to crack at times, to try to learn to read by fifth or sixth grade, and that is almost child abuse that they got to that point that they didn't know. So I'm backing down to first, second, and personally I think third is too late. But what one does in those areas, because by the time you've advanced them on to fifth grade or sixth grade, I believe you're absolutely right. I mean, I mean there's some huge...
Well, yes. And the earlier you address it, the better. And like I said, my wife's a reading specialist, and she likes teaching first grade because she likes teaching kids how to read. Many of them come in not knowing, and they go out knowing how to read. She doesn't have any support anymore. So you're just – retaining them is not going to solve the problem. It's, you know, it's providing the support they need. Like, they used to have reading groups. Walk to read at the, you know, they would all walk to different level reading they were at for a certain amount of time. They'd go, teachers would take, you know, the more experienced teachers would take the lower level kids. Well, they don't have that anymore because they don't have the staff to support it. They also don't have the pull out specific support for those kids that they know at that level need support. So I really think the answer to that is not retention, because you're going to put them through another year of the same thing and expect a different result. It's sort of insane, really, to expect that if you put them through the same program twice, they're going to somehow get it the next time. What they need is targeted support so that they can actually learn to read. That's my two cents on
those
retention.
Two cents.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you. This is Jeff Smith.
After listening to Eric here, I'm not sure you want to hear from me.
Definitely do. So
that's all we're looking for.
Because I could just say, I could just say ditto to,
yeah,
to what Eric
is. We're in this together,
said.
Really.
So, my name is Jeff Smith. I'm a teacher at Kodiak Middle School. I also am a parent of a sixth grader at Kodiak Middle School. You know, honestly, I don't even know really where to start.
What do you teach?
I'm a special education teacher.
Okay.
And I've been in the school district 18 years. And, you know, I think as I look at the funding and I look at what's happened this year in terms of some of the adjustments the districts had to make, I mean, there wasn't a choice, but things had to change, and how that's impacted the kids I serve. We used to have three special ed teachers in the middle school with a set number of students. This year we cut a teacher, we have two, and we have 15 more students. So our needs increased and our staffing went down because we couldn't sustain holding on to that teacher. So our class sizes went up. The individualized instruction has been modified, has been changed to meet the needs of a larger population. And that's just one of the areas that has directly impacted my students. I can't see us sustaining that for very long.
If I can ask you a question, and I hear what you're saying, and we heard folks talk about flat funding. In fact, that's between that and the BSA. Those are catchphrases we all use. So, but that being said, you know, we haven't flat funded. We've put in a lot of money in education. Now, we could have that discussion, but beyond that, what I heard you say is that you're growing in students, but you're taking away in teachers and support. And so students typically equal more money into the classroom. So I'm just asking you, and this isn't a I don't know the answer, and you may or may not either, but why do you have more students and then less money or less support in the classroom? Why do you think that?
Well, I'm not responsible for budgetary
decisions. Oh, certainly not.
I don't even want to venture to guess on that one, especially with who's sitting behind me.
I'm sorry. I heard you say, no, that's necessarily but, the more students. You have more students.
We have an increase of students this year. Our numbers this year,
right,
we ended up with more students that have special education needs.
Yeah,
and
I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No, not a bit.
I thought if you maybe thought, well,
I think the district probably received additional money or the same money for the same students because those students were in fifth grade last year, they're in sixth grade this year. It's a big group coming through.
Right.
However, when we look at the big scheme of the district, you have to adjust your staffing to meet the overall needs of the district. And when there's one pool of money that's earmarked to meet those needs, you've got to adjust those dollars. I mean, that's how a budget, I think, works.
Can you give me how many students you have?
This year?
Mm-hmm.
21. That's just that's on my load this year. My colleague has 18.
And do you do like a resource type special education, so where they come in for a certain
period,
time?
A period out of the day.
Yeah.
It's not like an elementary setting. It's one of their class periods out of the day. It might be in math. It might be in reading. It might be in
language arts. Special education. That's what I kind
of
figure on the resource or whatever they need the extra help with. They'll come in here for that particular class of middle school, and then they go back in.
Right.
And so you have 21 different lesson plans, basically. Each one of those students have their own thing going, similar.
Yes.
You know, versus the whole class we have.
You know, you brought up, and I tried to write quickly because I was trying to keep track of this, and so when you were talking to Eric, there was something you had said about that basically implied like tracking our students by SBA scores. So when we look at those standards-based assessments and we look at a student that might be low in math and we try to group those kids that are in a range of, let's say, 240 to 265, And so what that would end up doing in a middle school, a secondary level, is you would now take a group of kids and you would track them through the system. That same group of 20 students that would have math together would now have to funnel into an English class together because you can't switch it around. There's only so much staff. And so we don't group our students based on an SBA score.
Yeah, because what I was trying to figure out, because we're still trying to, from the Department of Education, really understand what the testing does, and whether we actually utilize it for what it's supposed to be, or we're just spending a lot of time on it, is that, for instance, you have math this period for all your seventh graders, and so you would use those numbers just to group that in there. Now, reading, this one who's low in math may be great in reading, so that it mixed together in the next hour, you know, would do that kind of thing. So I was more trying to get a feeling of whether or not, one, do you as teachers see those test scores to start with to get an idea of where they are? If you do, are they helpful at all? Or because maybe you're using something else that is more helpful, or maybe in September you're like, okay, we're going to go and try to figure out what's best for all these kids just kind of on the fly. And I know for some schools that is what they do.
Yeah, I don't do anything on the fly.
Yeah, no, because they don't have the information.
I'm not sure many of my colleagues do either, I can answer a couple of those.
So do you get the test scores, and are you able to use them, is what we're trying to figure out?
We are given access to the test scores when we get the results back. For my population of students, I look at it very closely.
Okay.
I look at the individual strands that are within those scores, look at numeration and measurement, geometry, see what area seems to be that lowest point for an individual student. But that's only one piece of data that I'm going to look at for students to say, how do we plan for this child? Because, to be quite honest with you, many of my students over the years, they sit down and they look at that SBA, they look at the length of it, and they go, you know, forget it. I mean, you're talking about a student that has a significant learning disability, and you put them in there to say, all right, we're going to spend X amount of time working on writing or reading or these math, and that's their area of disability. I've sat with students until 7 o'clock at night taking those tests, because they have to do it in one day. And you're not assessing a kid's effort. You know, you're assessing their knowledge. And so you've got a kid who sits there for hours working on those things and struggles their way through, but they want to give their best effort. Even if they don't have that ability or they're lacking that skill, they still want to put forth that honest effort. Now, there are accommodations now that allow us to take a student and take that test and break it and spread it over a couple of days or throughout the test window. But that wasn't there originally.
Right, okay.
So that's been an add-on. That's been a nice change.
When did that start? Do you remember off the top of your head?
Maybe within the last 3 years I think somewhere in that time frame. You know, but watching how those students struggle through those assessments. And I don't know that when that student sits down to take that assessment, I can tell you right now where that student's going to end up scoring approximately when we get that back. The kids I'm teaching math to this year, they're at a second and a third grade level. They're in sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. Okay, so I can use some norm referenced assessments. We use AIMS-Web as one of our screeners here, and I can assess the students, and I can progress monitor that student, and I can tell you my kids are making growth because I see it in the data week after week, and I see it on their assessments. Okay, come time to take the SBA in April, you're not going to see that. That student's making growth starting at second grade. If I take a kid who's at a second grade level.
We've been asking that question.
Right.
And the State Department, just so you know, that's the State Board, we ask that same question.
And you're not the first teacher.
No, but
my point is we hear that over and over. So this is you're right
child,
on the money.
Yeah, you take a child that's functioning at a second grade level, who's working hard, and at the end of this year, if that student's at a fourth grade level, that's 2 years of growth.
You know, we should all be doing the big hooray
right.
for that.
But you know what?
Correct.
We're not, because what we do then in April, and honestly, I'll just say it, I'll say it bluntly, we slap them in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And we say, here's a test at sixth grade curriculum level, seventh grade curriculum level, eighth grade curriculum level. Good luck. And what we end up doing is we defeat all that success we've built in these children all year long that say you're working hard, you're making gains. We've got the data that supports it, but now here's how you're going to get measured. It's going to be no better when we switch to the next assessment for my population. It really isn't. They're still going to be asked to take an assessment that's not at their achievement level. It's not at their ability level right now.
And they all have IEPs,
yeah.
The ones that you see in your class, and it doesn't matter because it's all students.
See, and we want to slap people like you, not on the face, but on the back and say, good work.
Well,
you know, 2 years, that's huge. That's
right.
Huge in kids
right.
that don't have an IEP.
Oh,
so, I mean, 1 year is huge.
Mm-hmm.
So
but when you talk about a gap, because you mentioned retention, and when we talk about a gap in students,
mm-hmm.
and we say a student at third grade, and I wasn't aware of what you had talked about.
What do you mean?
When you had said there was, you were looking at some change in terms of policy with regards to third grade proficiency.
Well, there's actually a bill that's read over the House floor, and
right.
I chair education,
right.
so it was read in the Education Committee
right.
last year, that talks about if you can't read at a proficient level
right.
by third grade, then you
right.
don't go onward.
And so to build on what Mr. Baltenbaugh said, if I can just
sure,
interject
please.
Real quickly, is that I start to think about that and I look at my population or I look at a student that would say is in that gray area that struggles, they're a struggling learner, but they're still progressing. And we take that child because they're not at that proficiency level in third grade. And to think about retaining them so that we can give them that instruction, whether it be the same or be different, and then we say, all right, at the end of the year, if you're still not at a third grade proficiency level, are we going to retain them again? Is that the idea? We would continue to retain the student until they achieve third grade proficiency
level?
Since
this has not been thoroughly vetted
right.
by the committee.
Right.
It's not either one of our bills.
No.
But it is in my committee, and that's exactly why I ask you, because
right.
those are questions that I'm going to ask,
right.
and yeah. I know you'll be busy teaching school when it comes up, but I'm hoping that folks in the room that have an opportunity, I really want to hear from you. So.
Well, I would just ask, what are you going to do in year two
okay.
if that student still struggles?
And year
and
three.
In year three and in year four.
And I think we had the discussion on the plane.
We had the yeah. same discussion
yeah.
on the airplane because.
Thank you for having that discussion
because
yeah. it's a real discussion.
Well, my conversation is let's make assumption that this kid did not come from our school system, but rather came from somewhere else. So do we hold that kid back and now he's 15, but he's in third grade? I mean, at what point? I mean, I'm being ridiculous, but maybe I'm not.
Mm-hmm. We play the devil advocate with each other quite a bit.
Right.
To try to flush all those. Because we know with every change you try to make, there's going to be consequences
mm-hmm.
that we may not see until it's too late, and we really
right.
don't want to go down that
right.
road again. I think we've been down that road. I think we're probably down that road somewhat now. But
well,
we are very concerned, so you know, of the testing and what may be chosen, how that's going, and we're, you know.
And I'm not opposed to accountability.
No.
You know, not my
I mean, what testing, but if you can already tell where that student's going to be
right.
before we frustrate them.
Right.
And just so you know, when the state board was in Nome, I actually testified to exactly that. We had been to a couple villages.
Right.
So exactly what you were talking about. And they're not even special education students.
Right. And there's
right.
not all of them. Not.
Right.
I mean, we've got a lot of gray area students that are in that gap.
That was the question. Yeah. How do we expect to see a growth if I'm giving a fourth grade test to somebody on a second grade level? Because what would parents say if I took a fourth grade test and said we're going to give this to second grade children?
Right.
They would all be up in arms, but we're doing those kinds of things and not being able to measure the growth that we're really trying to do.
Right.
So,
another piece as we talk about tests that I want to share with you is that, you know, with the new evaluation system that's come into play this year around the state, and that state assessment is being one of those tools that is going to be used to evaluate a teacher's effectiveness. What happens to somebody like me or my colleagues, that you could walk into my classroom tomorrow and you're more than welcome to. And you can look at the students that I'm working with and you can see where they're progressing and where they're not. And I can show you the growth and I can show you if the student's not making growth, what we are doing to adjust what we're doing so that child gets another hit on that material in a different way until that child gets enough hits that all of a sudden they can say, I get it. I have ownership of this now. And that's not going to happen in 9 months for some of my kids. So what's going to happen on that evaluation? How does that play out? Because that's one of the pieces that's going to be used by the state to say, Jeff Smith, you're a rock star teacher. Or Jeff Smith, you're pretty darn good. Okay? Or Jeff Smith, based on that assessment, on a student that's at a second grade level that's being tested a 6th, 7th, or 8th grade level. I have a concern about that, just so you're aware of that. Because it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Appreciate that.
So I don't really have a whole lot more to say. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your questions. And
thanks for allowing us to grill you. I mean, really, that's how we learn. So I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't know whether Doug is still here. It's had a maybe. Okay, maybe he left then.
Okay, I have next person who wants to testify, Pat Olson.
Hi, I'm Pat Olson, and I'm a teacher at Kodiak Middle School with Jeff. I came because I know the state is very interested in the health of our children, as evidenced by the obesity grant that you've given to 8 districts. And I think you've commissioned a survey. I forget if it was 25,000 or 40,000 for how much physical education time there are in our schools statewide. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm here.
And what do you teach in middle school?
Physical education.
Okay, I thought that. Didn't want to assume, you know.
Grades 6, 7, and 8 are our middle school. And this year, we did not replace some of our teachers. And over the years, I really have lost count of how many teachers we have cut. Last year, one of our PE teachers retired, and we did not replace her. So how it directly affects the health of our students is instead of 36 weeks of physical education, they get 24. And we rotate them through 3 weeks with me, 3 weeks with another PE teacher, 3 weeks of health. So they sit for 3 weeks and do not have the benefit of the 6 weeks that they just spent building up their endurance and strength.
Oh, can you do the math for me again? I'm sorry. So 24 weeks instead of 36 weeks, right?
So they spend 6 weeks in PE and then go to 3 weeks of health.
Oh, and then back to 6 and then back to 3.
Correct.
That's where my math was breaking up there. Thank you.
And with the amount of with obesity in our state and the obvious interest of the state in health, that's one way that the cut or the non-increase in funding has directly affected the students at our school. Another thing I'd just like to mention about funding is I know there is pending legislation on vouchers. And
hold it.
Okay.
Yeah. First of all, it's not my legislation at all, although I would own it if it was. It is not legislation on vouchers. It is legislation on whether we can directly or indirectly fund private vendors.
Okay.
And since our Constitution doesn't let us do that, but each and every one of you know that we're already doing it. So should we continue doing something against the law, or should we at least be transparent, put it out there and say, can we continue doing this? Can we continue go to private vendors to get what we need? And really, that's what it is. Now, it's a lot of folks say that it's vouchers and Islamic schools, and well, I've heard it all. But really, if you look at the wording, that's really what it is.
So to
please
go in,
carry on. Sorry, I'm just.
along whatever.
But either way,
the money that I see, if we do continue or expand that in your explanation for accountability, we don't have any accountability. I believe a lot of the money that we are spending on private education now, or vendors as you called it, there is some accountability to the state or to a local school district. The way I understand the parental choice bill is different. So I would not want even more money leaving state coffers to go into another area of education when we can't even support what we're trying to do now.
Right, and just for an explanation, and this is what makes it hard, is that you can't make the plan without it going for a constitutional change first, for yes or no. But from my understanding, if any public money were to go into any other school, whether it would be a private school or not, most likely the same type of testing that's being utilized in the public schools would be, they would have to also do. For instance, we have a Catholic school in Fairbanks, and they do the Iowa Basics on their own. They're not required to do the SBAs because they don't take any funding.
Correct.
They take transportation, but
I don't want to correct you that they do have public funding
services. They also
they have those. So, but the likelihood is, though, if public funding went,
you know, so would go the accountability. It's just like our students who take homeschooling programs. You know, they take
right.
the money, they have to agree to the testing as well. But that is what makes this bill very hard, because you have to put forward a constitutional change, yes or no. And then, depending upon what that answer is, then you go to Section 2, and if people could see the whole plan at once, it would make it much easier, but they don't allow us to do that. But
you can't put the cart before the horse. But
mm-hmm.
SJR 9, for folks, that's the Senate. So it's not mine.
But on the accountability portion of it, you know, and for PE, you know, how do you, because we don't completely understand the teacher portion of it. How has the district had any conversations with you or with the teachers in general, how you would you be judged in PE? Because really until that was brought up on,
all
parts of it, how would you be judged whether your kids were doing seventh grade PE?
I don't know.
Okay.
Right now we're observed based on, you know, teacher accountability to 41 domains or standards.
Right.
I'm not sure.
It's supposed to be based on growth, and I'm just
right.
trying to figure out how teacher growth is.
Assessments in PE, we have never graded a student on their ability.
Right.
It's on their participation and effort and knowledge of what we teach, but not if they can bump a volleyball 8 out of 10 times. I mean, we look at standards,
mm-hmm.
but we have not graded on those standards.
I'm glad certain things haven't changed, because for me, I probably wouldn't have helped my teacher at all. But the effort was there.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just kind of curious, because it really didn't, until that was said, that I think we think academically and sometimes forget some of those others, or the judgment's completely different.
It is.
So we appreciate that. Thank you so much for taking time to
Thank
come.
Thank you for coming.
Thanks for the conversation.
Okay, and I think we are now back to Deborah Kirk. And if somebody said that they didn't want to testify and they changed their mind, that is absolutely okay.
I guess I'll just kind of, I don't think this is very long. I just put a few things down here, and I'm going to start with Alaska Standard.
And for the record, can you tell us who you are and who you represent?
Deborah Kirk, School Board.
Thank you.
Part of my conversation is personal, it's not school board.
Okay,
So Alaska Standards, they require a lot more effort by teachers and students and parents. Their achievement sets a new higher level of attainment than we've had yet. Turn all this. But teachers are unhappy because for a lot of reasons. Part of it is small pay increases, more work to meet the new standard. The results are in the classroom, producing at times a stressful, negative atmosphere. It's tough for kids to endure on a day-to-day basis. What expenses are more important than the education of our kids? New roads, aerospace development, more hatcheries, bigger universities. I would ask you to cut back on all of these things before cutting back on education of our most vulnerable population. Frustration levels at this time are very high. Inadequate funding at this time is a recipe for disaster, leaving many children at risk. Please fix what we have in place, not reduce funding to the point where the current school model no longer works. In effect, chucking it in favor of private enterprise, if that is the goal of some. And I think that I'm talking about SJ9.
Mm-hmm.
And to divert from what I wrote, if I just heard you say that you're mm-hmm. they're going to have to meet quotas for special education, just like public school does, is that going to be part of this?
Really is a constitutional amendment to allow public monies to go to private vendors.
Mm-hmm.
We already do that.
Mm-hmm.
We already are breaking the law.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not necessarily talking. I mean, it is really mushroomed into this religious school aspect, but we're already spending public dollars to private vendors.
Mm-hmm. I guess my point is, though, they can choose who they admit, where we can't choose who we admit.
Who's they?
The private schools.
Well, again, I don't think this is
To answer the question is, again, the program or how that money would be dispersed,
mm-hmm.
There would have to be a bill after the question was answered on the ballot.
Oh,
so let's say the ballot was no, it just dies right there. If it was yes, then another bill would have to be presented and have to go through the whole process of it on how that would be utilized.
Mm-hmm.
And
Okay,
a few years back, there was a bill kind of that
went into it, but right now there is only that portion of it.
Okay, so I'm speaking about the possible outcomes of it.
Some of the things that could possibly happen.
Well, and I'll tell you another thing that possibly could happen, and I'm not making any threats, but I mean this is a conversation that happens. That could happen is we could stop allowing any public funds to go to private vendors. Mm-hmm. So there's two sides to this, and I'm not saying that which side's the right side. But I do know that what we're doing right now, that could be devastating to some of the programs that we have, be it CESA, be it a lot. I mean, there's a whole list of things that we do. And so, you know, it's a discussion. It's out there. Folks are saying before we get sued, before we have another Moore, Casale case or whatever, what do we do? Mm-hmm. Our Constitution does not allow this. What do we do? So it has moved into where we would allow kids to pay public money to private religious schools. That seems to be a big focus. But I think that the bigger thing that folks talk about is what are we doing right now even for the governor's scholarship where kids can get a scholarship and go to a private university. So we're putting public dollars towards a private school already there.
Right. And
so that's part of the conversation, and that's the only reason I bring it up, is that that's the bigger part of that particular conversation.
Yeah, and I understand all that stuff's going on, and at this point I'm not complaining about any of that. I'm just, I guess, talking about some of the ramifications that I see going on in other parts of the country that are part of this conversation.
Right.
Well.
And I have a question as a school board member. We use the word accountability, and I know – I've gotten better about using that word too often. My school district have taught me. But when we're looking at, you know, being able to make, you know, we're a big state, and we know people have bad days sometimes when it comes to testing, yet, you know, you can't have a driver's license unless you pass a test. You can't become a doctor without passing a test, and a lawyer, and even a teacher. I mean, you have to pass a test to get there. And if you don't pass it, you have to go back and take it again. And I think that's where some of this testing has come from. Mm-hmm. For your own district, is there a better, you know, what way do you judge your students now, you know, to make sure that third grader is ready to go to fourth grade and the fourth grade to the fifth grade if it's just not a test?
You know, that's a good question for, I don't know, just,
okay. Because, I mean, that's just what we're struggling with, because we do understand the concept of, you know, one test doesn't necessarily do it, especially, and I'm not going to go into the IEP thing. I've got my special education degree. I don't think those children should be doing the same thing. That's why they have an IEP. So I completely understand what you're talking about. We're going to try to rectify some of that.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that.
Yeah.
My kids would appreciate
Yeah, because that's what an IEP for. But for the rest, you know, I don't know whether or not, you know, when you do AIMS Web, I know a lot of districts who use it go through a very big matrix. Mm-hmm. In how they measure and keeping track of them that way, and whether that would be a better thing. So I just didn't know as a school board member. If you don't know, well,
I don't know. You'd have to ask me to do it.
No, no problem. So is there anything else you'd like to add?
I do. This is a personal point. I don't know if you read the paper, but we just had a gun incident in our school this last week. So this point is less directly related to sustainable funding, but no less important. I'm speaking as an individual here, not necessarily as a school board member, but in my opinion, I think that the conceal and carry permits, I would use the word lunacy, that are mushrooming by my accounts in Kodiak and perhaps statewide. I have no idea how many are out there. I know people advertise on Facebook for classes and, oh, it's full, sign up in 6 weeks or whatever. We don't have a huge population. That really worries me. So Alaska has a lot of strongly opinionated constituents, but not all of them are mentally stable. Please don't allow suggestions for the funding of guns in the schools for protection. I'd like to see guns out of the picture. I realize that you're from conservative districts, but gun control would be a good idea, in my opinion, because we did find the gun in our school just a few days ago.
Right.
And as an elected official, it scares me because I feel like a target.
And I don't know
if you ever feel that way, but...
And on that legislation, you know, it could not happen mm-hmm. unless the school district, it had to go through the Board of Education. It couldn't just be done. I signed on to that particular one of them. And
well, before Stuart beats me at the same subject, and I'm going to let him chime in on it, I was on the school board in the MATSU when somewhere in the lower 48, some guy got up at a school board meeting, tried shooting the school board people, and finally the woman with the purse came and walloped him. Personally, I was real proud of that woman as the men all ducked underneath there. Sorry, guys. But I think it's school district by school district that can allow teachers to pack. And
Stuart, not currently they can.
Yeah, they can.
I wanted to help one, Deborah, make sure that...
If you could move forward, please, so that others can hear.
Yeah, because that's why you don't need Bob.
I want to, first off, help clarify one of the things. Alaska does have the capacity to issue a permit for concealed a weapon. However, Alaska has laws in place. You don't have to have a permit. It's legal to carry a concealed weapon no matter what. Now, the state also has provision that says the only way an adult can have a gun in school is with written permission from an administrator. I've said it to the newspaper. We've said it at the board level. We've said it everywhere. No one has permission to bring a gun into our school except for law enforcement. We do have an air rifle club. We make that exception. But the idea of the concealed weapon thing. And so, Deborah, to further emphasize your point, mm-hmm. the lunacy of the idea that there's absolutely no measurement, management at all of the concealed weapon, it does spill out into some pretty unusual circumstances which we're currently going through. That's
right.
All I wanted to
and
mention.
And I'm just saying that as an individual.
No, I'm not her turn. Thank
and
you.
Yeah, so I think that the larger gun control issue is a big issue.
And I think, and are you speaking to that there is a bill out there looking at potentially allowing teachers to have guns?
You know, I'm not really speaking to any bill. I think there's just too much out there.
Yeah,
I agree with that.
Okay.
There's way too many out there.
I hear you. Thank you very much. Okay, Kim Saunders?
Hi.
Thank
you. Sorry that I'm late.
There is no light to a public.
Well,
so, you know,
I wish I had been here for the entirety of the conversation.
You can hear it. You can re-listen to it over.
Yes. I don't miss anything.
There you go. And then if you have other comments you want to comment after you listen to it, feel free to shoot an email.
Awesome. Thank you. I have a few notes just because I
think
you could
just
give a
little name for the record. And
my name's Kim Saunders.
And you work or parent or both?
I'm both. Okay. I'm a teacher in the district here and a special education teacher with early childhood.
Okay.
And I'm in my 13th year, and I am raising two children, and I'm from Kodiak, born and raised, and home, doing good work, I hope. But I wanted to talk to you about how I don't feel like we can meet the needs of students with our current level of funding. And we certainly cannot do more with less. And really, that is my biggest frustration as an educator and as a parent. The needs are increasing, the funding is decreasing, and one-time money does absolutely nothing to support sustainable programming. We know that. We're a petro state, we have a ton of cash, and we can't seem to figure out a way to fund things at a sustainable level. I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if taking energy out of the BSA is the way to go. I don't know. But I can tell you right now in the classroom, you can only squeeze so tight and see students continue to make progress. And I'm frustrated, and I appreciate you coming, and I appreciate you asking questions and listening to people. But I'm fired up, and I wish there was something else I could do besides just sit in front of you and say I'm fired up about this issue.
You're from this community, and you said that the needs were increasing. So
yes.
The needs as in you're seeing
students.
More needs. Okay, so I'm just trying to get kind of more down to, is that more like special education students,
no.
Or are you just talking about that you're being
I'm talking kids coming in with less.
Describe
coming in with less skills.
Okay, that's
my
cool.
Students are coming in with less skills because they're plugged into technology from a very young age. They don't have the core strength to sit up to hold a pencil when they're 3 and 4. They're losing skills. They're coming in with less from their home.
And you see this because they have more computer access of just
Possibly. That's one reason that I believe, and that I think we're going to find some research to support, that kiddos who are plugged into technology do not develop the pre-academic skills that they had previously.
Okay.
And they're coming to us with less skills, less support. I can't tell you the amount of money that I spend every year. I could tell you. I could go back and find out for you. Meeting students' basic needs, whether that's coats or gloves or boots or whatever, breakfast, you name it. But we do our part to try to level the playing field for kids who have less. And then the standards have increased in rigor. So now my kindergartners don't have to count to 20. They have to count to 100. And that happened overnight, as if the playing field is level. And it just isn't. Kids come to us with all kinds of needs and all kinds of backgrounds. And we're being held accountable for their ability to make a certain amount of growth that is not started on a level playing field. It doesn't make any sense. And I'm sorry, but I'm
so there was measurement from the very beginning when that first week they got it, that they came in school. And you were measured from that first day to the last day versus assuming every kindergartner comes in and just, you know, my sister's taught kindergarten for like 30 years. Mm-hmm. So I've, you know, she shares her stories often. For that, you know, kids who can count to 200, 300, kids who don't even know what a number is.
Correct.
All sitting in the same classroom. So if there was a measurement from the beginning and then a measurement at the end, and would that make it, I may not solve it because everybody has a different growth, but would that change your feeling
no.
on the teacher back? So
what do you need to see to fund education? What do you need to see happen to pay us the money to do it right? Like, that's what I want to know from the legislature,
you know, I think
from the state.
I think that's an excellent question, and I'm not trying to be political, you know. They teach us that in politics media. But I think, you know, wait, you ever hear them? You know, well, that's a good question. But I think when you walk up and down the street of downtown and you talk to the businesses or go down to the boat harbor and they don't know you're a teacher, so they speak quite frankly to you. You know what people want? Is they want their kids to be able to read. The conversation is to what level, and it typically is between fifth, sixth, and some people will even say eighth. They're not happy now that they feel that that many of our kids, not the majority, many of our kids cannot read to a level that can get them to those quality, what do you say, 25 years, somebody said 25, 30 years, that can get them that job. They can't do the math and understand the relevancy. Some of them have passed very high math courses but have no, they can't figure out how many gallons need to be in this or how many volumes or how many linear feet of something. They just don't, they can't take that skill into
basic skill into
relevant skills that they would use day to day.
Okay.
But they have the theories. So when we go reading, writing, arithmetic, the general public is stating that they don't think our students are there. Now, we always tout, and they can too, that there are students that go to Harvard and do wonderful jobs in Dartmouth and whatever. But the businesses that are hiring those kids, be they Walmart or wherever it is, geez, our kids can't even count.
But the answer from the legislature then is to squeeze?
I don't know that that's the answer,
more,
but you ask, what is it that people are wanting? And that was what I was kind of giving back to you.
But when the legislature is looking at the cost analysis of public education, and you're lumping all these monies together, and we haven't had an increase to the BSA in 7 years or whatever it is on that sustainable number, that number that we can build something on, if we don't see an increase to that number, how are we going to not only sustain programs but build better ones, which is really what we should be about, right? I don't understand. We see increases in education funding. If you look at the literature that comes out of the legislature, it says, you know, we've got $21 million in safety money last year. That's a lot of money, absolutely. But I can build absolutely nothing on that as an educator. As a teacher in the classrooms with kids, I can tell you my staff has been cut, teachers around me have been cut. We cannot reach them. This is my love. This is what I do, and I know how to do it well. And you are setting me up, and you're setting kids up for failure. And it is unfair to hold me and my students to a standard and then tell me you're going to give me less money to make it happen. That is just, like, it makes me crazy.
But I want to clarify a few things that made this problem where it's at. I mean,
right.
In the last 4 to 5 years, we started with the stimulus funding.
Right.
That all came in. And it was a big chunk of stimulus money that came in.
Correct.
What was interesting, that was before I was in the legislature.
I thought that was really
fun. throw that in there. Because it came in right afterwards,
right.
And what I found it was interesting was that there was some kind of agreement out there that the stimulus funding wouldn't be used for more staff, which I find interesting because you're in an industry that is based on staffing. So I'm just saying I thought that was very interesting. That,
right.
And I don't know who made the agreement. But right behind that came Jobs for America.
Right.
Okay, so we had a lot of money thrown,
federal money,
4 or 5 years that didn't have as many strings attached to it as the title monies
right.
have together, title funding has together. So what's happened is that, yes, the growth of education is what, as far as the state has gone up. I mean, it has not gone down. The BSA, which is a small part of the formula, has stayed the same in the last 3 years, but there was other things put in. The geo difference was put in, more for special education, plus the one-time funding. But the biggest loss here that the districts found was now that federal money was gone.
Right.
And you built programs on it because that's what you do, you know.
Correct.
Well, it had to go somewhere. And even if you put it into technology, and that's what you put it into, technology still has to have people behind it to keep it going as well. I mean, just about anything you put into it.
Right.
But the district found it, but it was an increase, you know, on the federal. And the state didn't make up that difference, you know, on that. You know, and we're not, and just like, and you know, I understand, you know, and we're hearing this whole thing, but we're not looking to cut education. What we're trying to do to start with is figure out the formula that was put together, you know, what all was inclusive of it. Did anybody ever have an idea that 20% of that was supposed to go to energy and 20% of, you know, that was supposed to go here and 70% to, you know, what were the percentages to start with and then how has that gone? Up or down, like healthcare. Nobody ever thought it would go up as high as it did, as fast as it has in the last few years.
Right.
So, you know, so we're looking at that and saying, well, if we took healthcare out of the formula, you know, and that was something that the state took over, how would that impact? And that's kind of what we started with energy with that first $25 million came. If we took a lot of that big energy cost out,
right.
Would that do it? You know, because, and then you have every district has reasons it's gone up. You
right.
know, the further out you get into more of the, you know, village areas, you know, it's not just health care. It's also, you know, they have the problem with transportation got higher, you know, plus the energy costs. You get into some of the urban areas, it's gotten to where, you know, more special education type needs, but they don't qualify for special education.
Right.
So they still need more. But you don't get that extra bump because it's not that much more.
The same as remote versus
yeah.
rural.
Right. So we're trying to take one formula.
Same, yeah.
Right. We're trying to take one formula and make it work for the entire state.
Right.
You know, that was invented. So, you know, what we're trying to do is, you know, what exactly, you know, for local control is there on the money? Because it is the state's responsibility, you know, to make sure the children are educated. You know, we've handed a lot of that responsibility on the local level. But what do we do if we know the children aren't succeeding? This is one of the best school districts, the only reason we're here, in the state. I mean, we can look at your scores, you know, and we do. Just so you know, we do look at what you're doing, and we know what you've been doing in the past has worked for your area and most of it.
Right.
You know, you still got a couple struggling areas, and everybody does. But overall, you probably have more 4- and 5-star schools by the percentages of most districts in this state. So, you know, and that's why we're here. We're trying to really look at that formula because there's nothing in the history, and I've gone all the way back to the BIA schools, of how that got formulated and how they thought it would get divided. We can look at, though, from districts as they come through our offices in Juneau and as we've been out, healthcare is huge and energy is huge. You know, personnel, I don't think personnel, the cost is growing any more than it would normally grow as those other two areas have.
substantially. And so, you know, if we keep the formula similar to what it is and we're able to take some of these big chunks out and still keep it to where you're, you know, we're not decreasing it over here, we're taking some of the cost out, will that at the end of the day get us where we need to be?
Right.
You know, and so, you know, as these bills come forward, you know, to do parts of that, you know, will that give us that parity that we're required to have and give you more money for the classroom, because now that one big source is
right.
something that comes out.
And I think creatively looking at funding is really important.
Right.
But I also just feel like to say that we're one of the best districts in the state, which I believe that we are, that's why I came home to teach, because it's a great place to live, it's a great place to raise my children, but we will not be
right.
if it goes away. And that is just logical. I mean, it doesn't make sense to tell me that we are to do more and you are to give us less to do the same or better. And you can't tell me to teach harder.
Right.
You cannot.
And
I cannot teach harder than I teach every day.
And what we're trying to tell you is that we don't expect you to do more with
well,
us.
I do feel that way.
Yeah.
I do. I feel
yeah.
very strongly that the
right.
state, that the state, not you. I don't feel like you're telling me that.
No.
I feel like
that.
The funding patterns
right.
are saying that to me.
But we know we have 58 other people that work with us,
yes.
so we
right.
don't. We
exactly.
will understand.
And two of them, you know, are yeah, local. Anyway, you know that there's it's designed that way. For
I guess I want you to look at, you know that, you know what, you know, as we've been going to as many communities as we can. You know, during this interim and speaking to each of the communities and having literally walking down the streets and having conversations and town hall meetings just on the spur like that is to get this kind of information because, you know, you're right. People, you know, there's this thing right now about putting money into the formula, but there might be less problems with taking things out of the formula but keeping it the same, but this cost goes out of it. And at the end of the day, that works if it still gives you more money over here. And so that's what I'm letting you know is that
right.
part of this whole portion of it is, you know, some of the bills that started last session, that was the intent to hope to be able to not just save money for the district, but save money for the entire, especially for, like, the health care. The bigger the pool, usually the smaller, you know, the cost is overall for everybody versus all the small school districts trying to have.
And I'm not sure
people.
Kodiak would save money. I think that's a conversation.
Well, that's one thing that we're going to be looking at. So, yeah, and that's
well, and
one
there's
part
an
of.
RFP, and I have the House bill on the House side in regards to that. And if it doesn't have the efficiencies, then, of course, we won't push it forward. I mean, the intent was to try to look for efficiencies
exactly.
and have the state help all of the school districts. So, you know, I know I've had people kind of squawk a little bit about it, but if it doesn't, then we won't push it forward. I just want to make the statement that I heard Stuart loud and clear, but I've heard many other superintendents having been on the school board and a business owner. We would never operate a business in the manner that we operate our school districts. And I know those listening, some will be challenged, but it's just not a way that you operate business. There are folks that tell me that schools are not a business, our children are not our business, but you know what it is? There are certain business fundamentals that we do work with, and those are budgeting, costs, labor. This is a business, and we're not running it like a business as a state. When we talk about, not only in Alaska, in the middle of the winter when people are at their roughest, when we're trying to run, you know, get a budget going so that you're trying to figure out if you're laying people off, what you're doing, this is poor timing. Having been a parent that you would usually start in about March, then I swear I wondered if there was really any teaching going because of the angst with the teachers. As they said, you know, we're doomed. We're going to have to pay for paper. We're not going to make it, whatever, that type of a thing. And this would go on for years and years. You know, the plus is your kids finally grow up, graduate, and you're not hearing it anymore. But there's a new crop of parents hearing it, and it's very disruptive on both sides. So I we're aware of that. We're aware that teachers have that challenge, and I don't think they're at their best when they have that kind of angst. And I don't think that parents and kids are at their best when they're trying to wonder what's happening tomorrow. So we are aware of that. So I appreciate that comment again.
Thank you.
So we're trying to pull it apart. I guess that's our message. We're trying to pull the pieces that we do know that's part of the formula at this point, and how can we do some better adjusting. Just for instance, on the energy, we were very concerned when we went back to this department. We said, well, how much? What are the energy costs for each district? So we know whether or not we're anywhere close, and they didn't know.
Right.
You know, and I'm like, that's an easy, I mean, I can call somebody in this district, and they would probably be more than happy to tell me what the fuel bill is and what the electricity bill is and those types of things, because what we did a few years ago, we put money toward energy. The
right.
follow-up was supposed to be, well, what is energy cost right now? And we did the same thing for transportation a couple of years
right.
ago, to where we put actually an individual now who's supposed to be looking at, you know, a statewide contract, so maybe we can save some money in that area. I think some of it, we started the good ideas down the road. We got to do much better on the follow-up
mm-hmm.
to make sure that how did that $25 million go with what we thought was supposed to be covered under the formula in the first place on the excess? And we won't know unless we get the information.
Right.
You know, and so we've spent a lot of time, when you can come to my office anytime, Fairbanks, and
yeah,
say, facts, trying
Call
to
me
come up
if
with
I
that.
Can help in any way, Paul.
We absolutely will. You know, yeah. Well, you know, if there's some suggestions that come to you, so please, you know, give us a call, shoot us an email. You know, and talk to other teachers. I mean, if they couldn't make it today and they have comments they were unable to make, we would greatly appreciate to hear from them.
Just my last note, which is personal and is an idea, which just has to do with, I realize this is not a popular state idea, but you are more than welcome to my dividend, and you're welcome to that of my children's dividends, and I would like to see it go directly into their education. And I think it's a great idea to consider only school-age kids' dividends going to an educational fund. And so voters who don't have kids who are not invested as much in the education system don't have to give up that benefit, and something that they would fight, I have no doubt. But by all means, please use that money and invest it in education. So that's just...
We won't leave any rocks unturned. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for what
thank
you do.
You.
No, and I'm going to interject real quick for those listening, and so you can go back, or for those who want to write. My staff loves this when I do it, because I usually get about 20 more hits. But if you want to keep up on what this task force is doing, you will get an update if you sign on to housemajority.org/sustainable-education-task-force. Or you can just go to housemajority.org, go on to Representative Lynn Gaddis's page or Representative Tammy Wilson's, and you'll see the task force. You click onto it and say, add me.
Oh, we will?
Yeah.
Wow, I'll have to go check.
That's what we've been doing. So they'll be thrilled to know that there will be folks listening on. But then you can keep up on anything that is happening on the task force. You can email, you can say, hey, I want, don't forget this, I heard you say that. So, you know, it's folks like you that are in the trenches that tell us, that's very, very helpful, and we'll be glad to share back and forth. So, you know, we're in this together, we Alaskans.
And next week we'll be in Kenai doing technology. We're having anybody who does technology come and talk to us, not just about the appliance that they have, but teacher development. We want to see the whole package deal. Because I had this nice little iPad for probably a year and a half, to 2 years before it actually came out of my drawer, because they gave it to us and said, here, this is really cool. I had no idea what to do with it. And now that I finally had time to kind of do it, but we know that if we're going to bring technology in, we have to have the teacher development and the rest to go with it. Did you want to testify, ma'am?
I would love to.
Please come. You could just sit. And then we have another one here that changed her mind.
So the
maybe 16th
and 17th public... task force, 2 days. If you go and sign on, even the audio will be archived. You can always listen to it later. So if you sign on, you'll get that update. So 16th and 17th, we'll be meeting in Kenai.
The task force?
The complete task force, yes. And they get the recording of this as well, just so you know. We do force our task force to pay attention. So if you could give your name for the record.
I appreciate the opportunity. I'm Lisa Pierce. I'm the Chief Business Officer here in Kodiak. I appreciate the opportunity to jump into the conversation and appreciate the opportunity, but want to apologize in advance for the quick preparation. So I apologize that it's not, if it's rambling, but I've heard a couple of things that have spurred my interest in particular, and I was taking notes along the way. And of course, you just mentioned the correlation between, you know, the application of the business model versus an education model, and should it not be the same? I believe that yes, it absolutely should be the same. But I also want to stress that we're operating under a complete different set of restrictions. GASB does not exist in private sector, so we're bound by a different set of rules. The state has the one-time funding. Those opportunities for funding have been wonderful for us. There's strings attached. They're not always great. It doesn't free up. There's certainly, for instance, the energy opportunity 2 years ago, one-time funding, which that was continued, which was very gratefully accepted because, again, that almost becomes a necessity at that point in time. It just almost prolongs the agony if it doesn't become a sustainable piece. The safety and security pieces this year very much appreciated the opportunity for the flexibility of those funds, but am concerned about the possibility of those funds going away at that level again, because I don't know that a $21 million level for safety and security is truly a defendable allocation on an annual basis. I think on an influx, it's great. We really appreciated the flexibility to be able to utilize those based on ADM and to utilize those for energy and other fixed costs. We did place some of those funds into safety and security, but did purchase some curriculum materials with that. One of the model pieces that, in particular, that comes to mind in private sector, are capital purchases. Those are not a one-time shot. It was mentioned on the stimulus funds, and don't put them into. We could not put anything of the stimulus funds. Well, we were encouraged not to put anything into staffing, which it would have been detrimental to do so because it was not a sustainable piece of money. But so what happened was this district in particular used that for huge capital investments. Well, a lot of that was put into technology investments, very short lifespan. The depreciation cycle on those is a 3-year life cycle. We're sitting on a bubble right now with instructional devices that are Generation 1 iPads that are basically unusable, very quickly meeting or exceeding their lifespan. Private sector would allow us an opportunity to do some depreciation saving. I'm not seeing within the state here that we have that capacity to do so. The potential to do a depreciation reserve set forth based on our depreciation schedule on our GASB 35, be able to take our capital assets, see what our actual investment should be, establish a reserve fund aside from the 10% cap on fund balance, because we cannot have that defeats its purpose.
Right.
That in and of itself takes away that feast and famine approach of, or lurch and jerk, or however you want to look at it, that, oh, my gosh, we have a huge influx, $2 million worth of funds from the stimulus. We make a responsible investment, but we're just waiting to pay the piper, and we're the piper screaming for payment at this point. I would really encourage that we look at some sort of a depreciation reserve option. Would like to be a part of those conversations, have some thoughts on how that can be established. It allows for that planning for those purchases. You also touched on the health insurance options, Senate Bill 90. We were fortunate to be able to be part of the testimonies this summer for the Senate Education Finance Subcommittee.
Right.
What just rung loudly to me during that, I believe there were 8 districts that presented. The business officials that were part of that, we got together very quickly a couple of times on the phone just to have a consistent format. We never once discussed amongst ourselves what our presentations were actually going to look like and what our numbers were coming out to be. What just sung very loudly to me was the consistency that the utility costs, but in particular the health insurance costs, over that 10-year period that we were asked to report on, those costs by those eight districts went up 180 to 200% across the board. That was phenomenal, phenomenal. If I recall the salary piece of those, I shouldn't maybe even say, I'm thinking it was within a 30 to 35% range, but health insurance was an 180 to 200% increase. Large capacity. Senate Bill 90, I think, has some merit. I really do. On a personal level and from this district standpoint, I don't know that it's the best thing for us. Now, it may be. Have not seen what the options would be. I would highly encourage an opportunity for districts to take the opportunity to join a pool.
Mm-hmm.
And not what I'm understanding Senate Bill 90, and maybe I misunderstand, but what I understand it to be is the establishment of a separate pool for schools. Or is it that we would join the state pool? I really believe I've read that it would be a separate established pool.
It would be. Let me back up a minute. I'll
it's your
tell
bill,
you,
so I'm going to let her answer because I'm curious now.
And it's mine on the House side. And let me back up to its origination. On the school board in the MATSU, and the person who has the Senate side is also on the same school board on the MATSU at the same time.
Yeah.
So what we did is we ran the numbers. We weren't in the same crunch as any of these other school districts. And we're like, where can we find the efficiencies? This is killing us. It's going up. So we had our CFO at that time, which thank you for our present CFO, Kodiak, by the way. Thank you for Luke. Just thought I'd throw that out there. Seriously, though. We had our CFO at that time run the numbers and run the forecast of where we were headed, and we said, we have got to head this off. We thought, can we self-insure? Well, huge, yeah, we could do this. What can we do? So we played a lot of gyrations with the numbers to see what we could do to get ahead of it before we jumped off the cliff. With that in mind, that's the information that as we have two school board members that now go to the legislature and say, hold it. Other school districts may or may not have the same. We have the advantage to having some folks and having that look. What does it look like? What can we do? So now that we have where the intent and what the history is, as we got into this, we said these same folks, these same educators, when they retire, they go into the state. So even though we don't know the actuaries now on them, the state gets them because when they retire, then you're in the state. So what happens if we take them now and we're actually able to make it cheaper for everybody all along, including when you retire? Then we took a step farther because there are folks, and, you know, I got interest from small businesses, and they said, hold it, what if we jump in? Will you let us? And so the conversation has come. And I'm not going to say this is like Obamacare, but it's like a health care option for folks in Alaska to be able to utilize a volume discount. But with that in mind, did we know enough about the complete state? We really only knew with the MATSU School District. We couldn't really mandate something for the whole state without doing the research. Research should be out, what are we, in December? In a week or two. So we'll know the answer that the RFP that they went out and got, and I don't have any hint even. So, but I hear where you're coming from, and we've sat in the same shoes going, what are we going to do?
Yeah. But wait, I have the same question still. So would, sorry, so, I didn't know what this is either. So
the door is open.
Would it be separate, or would they go into the state plan as it is? Because that's my understanding. It would go in the state plan. The school district, the schools wouldn't have their own.
You are correct.
The schools would have all their own?
No, the schools would be in a whole large educator trust.
Why?
Because we're still working on it.
Okay.
I mean, it hasn't gone through committees. It really hasn't gone through a lot.
That's interesting, because I'm glad you brought that up, because it was – I had the reverse understanding.
Yeah, and that was my understanding. Now, whether that's the right way or not, I don't know. There may be benefits to doing that.
Right.
To speak frankly, some of the benefits that I could see right up front from, again, my limited knowledge of the existing state plan, I would be very disappointed if the districts were limited to the offerings that the existing state plan has.
Yeah,
I think that the existing state plan could really –
I want to know what hers is.
Could really do some I don't want to say creative because that can have negative connotations,
mm-hmm.
but I would say proactive planning
mm-hmm.
and adjustments on some options. You know, we've all heard the issues of the Cadillac tax coming down the road. Well, that's a ways out there. I'll grant you that. But I do think that there are options. I just came from a staff meeting with one of our employee groups this afternoon that we're rolling out a high deductible plan.
Mm-hmm.
Very well received. Very excited for our
mm-hmm.
folks that are able
mm-hmm.
to participate in that. And what my understanding is that the existing state plan doesn't have that option in place.
No.
I would hope that if we're going to set a separate policy or a separate program for the districts,
mm-hmm.
that they allow those options and allow some within these are options that are allowed within IRS code.
Oh, yeah.
And so why not take advantage of those structures and allow our people to have those options? And I would encourage the state to look at that at their level as well. But.
Well, and I can tell you from the intent of the original conversation, going back to the two folks on the school board, so I know where we're coming from, both of us had already had insurance through somewhere else. So the school district was paying approximately $18,000 per person for a school board member. But we said, we're already insured. Got a deal for you. What if you just pay the difference between my copay and cover, you know, and I think it came for both of us. Maybe one was a couple thousand and myself was $1,000, but that was a win-win. So what we looked at is what about the young person that's relatively healthy, that wants high deductibles and definitely is male, not planning on getting pregnant. I know that that's kind of something out there with the Obamacare they're chuckling about. But more importantly, what if they don't, and they'd like to put some of that benefit money in their own personal pocket? Of course, the district saves as well. Again, it becomes a win-win. And so those were some of the things that we looked at. So not treating every employee the same because they have different needs.
They do. Exactly,
right.
And that's very important.
So I want you to know that both of our intents, I mean, we spent a lot of time speaking on the Mat-Su School Board about that. And so as we move forward, we're still the same people with that same intent.
Thank you for the clarification.
Can I touch on one other issue?
Go right ahead.
I'm sorry.
No. In fact, I want your card because I really want your input as we move on.
Okay,
so.
I appreciate that. The other piece of it, and again, going back to the private industry model,
mm-hmm.
You have business plans.
Mm-hmm.
I would hope that a private industry has a 3 to 5 year business plan.
You're speaking my language.
Did you hear it circling around there in the fog? I don't know about this.
We've got to look at a forward funding capacity.
Yes.
It's really tough.
And you know, and people struggle with the fact that when we say forward funding, we already have a formula that forward funds. And I actually like the word a plan.
Perfect.
And because that doesn't allow people to get all caught up into the fact that we're forward funding, but really a plan.
That's right.
And a plan, as we've talked about, it, quantifies, defines, and you know when you're halfway through the plan, you know when you've 3/4, you're able to say, here's where I am. I can measure where I am in the plan.
We have no education plan in the state of Alaska. We kind of wing it.
We're
talking about winging it. I think, you know, we see a problem, and then we put several bills out trying to fix what we think the problem is, and sometimes our good intent doesn't come that way. So, but without a plan, a state of Alaska education plan, in which everybody is, and really right now is when the times are changing. I mean, whether we like it or not, the standards have changed. Curriculum's going to have to match, and then some kind of testing mechanism is being looked at as we're speaking right now, and we're not real sure how much we're, you know, excited about that. So, you know, if we'd had a plan going in this direction, we wouldn't be making all these changes. And then we kind of take all those changes and we say, well, you guys wanted local control, plop, here you go. You know, but local control.
And my response to that would be give us local control, but give us the opportunity to plan it.
Right.
Don't throw us into a situation with a set of rules that. And I don't mean to sound that this was ungrateful, because those security funds, they saved our bacon in a lot of ways. But it was a last-minute effort that, quite frankly, we got, you know when that came through.
Oh, sure.
We had to change a presentation to the borough, which was kind of a mud-on-the-face situation, because our original presentation to them was $400,000 less. Well, what do you mean? Where did this money come from? Well, it was a windfall. Very grateful for it, and we are. But again, that was a quick situation at the end. We go further down into our process, get into June. We have to adopt that, or actually finalize that budget, and our borough, last minute, 3 days before our final approval of a budget, decided at that point in time that they would fund us to the max. Again, greatly appreciated. But those timings put us into a situation where it appears that we're just in a folly. We're not given that opportunity to have that planning situation. I'm not saying those plans weren't in place. We were ready to roll. We knew what we were going to do. We had opportunities in those situations. But when it comes about very quickly, it lends a piece of skepticism amongst those people at the harbor. What in the heck are they doing there? Where did this come from? Mm-hmm. Well, it just fell from the sky, quite literally, in
right.
both of those situations, right. and grateful so. I don't mean to sound that those aren't grateful situations. But again, then we go further into the situation. Our budget starts July 1. We go further into it, get our actual count in October, certify it in November, and quite frankly, those numbers don't even get completely massaged and confirmed until February. We're more than halfway through our year before we have a guaranteed level of funding.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it tough to have a business plan.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it very difficult. And I appreciate that you recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that can be done to backtrack that, give us an opportunity to fund off of our ADM for the prior year.
Mm-hmm.
We can certify that level. On June 15th, we can give you a certified ADM count from the prior
mm-hmm.
year. And let us fund on that. Now, that's still a tight window, but it's better than February, 7 or 8 months down the road when we're more than halfway through our fiscal year, and then we get our number,
mm-hmm.
our magic number, and then it's like, well, again, well, why are they making these changes? Gosh,
mm-hmm.
we're halfway through the year. Well, we just now found out what our funding levels are.
Did you use
difficult?
Did you use your security money on 1 year because it was good for 5 years?
We used it in the 1 year. We used it for $75,000 of it was for the safety and security.
Mm-hmm.
$160,000 of it we put into curriculum materials, and then $206,000 of it went to health insurance
mm-hmm.
increases.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so there we are. So now, what happens next year? I sure hope those one-time funds are magically one-timed again.
And let me say this: your representative, Alan Osterman, he has recognized that there is a challenge, and he came to me with a task force bill already and said, Lynn, have I got a deal for you? And so I think these one-time batches of money pulled out at the 11th hour, I think our legislature knows that there's a problem. They just didn't know how to fix them. And so this is the year, as you well note, that the Senate has been working on it. We've been working on it. And it is not, I think that it was, it truly was meant that we've got to do something. And as we talk, as a school board member, these folks, they're not out of line. We rigged a system in which they have to work within. We can't not fund that system. So when I hear you have some ideas here, my question to you is, as I know the superintendents have a group of people that they network and talk with, as much as we love you coming down, we also need to hear from people like this, people with innovative ideas of how we can make changes in regulation, how we can do things, because truly it's that network. I mean, I talked to Luke quite a bit because he's the closest, because I know him, but I would really like to have that same network with other folks like yourself that really are in that particular aspect to say, here's some ways that we can do things. Here in my mind is where we would start this, so on and so forth, because we do need to make those changes. But I don't know what regulations there is that your hands are tied. So hopefully you'll help us.
Like to know.
Yeah.
And
yes.
Was there anything else you'd like to add?
No.
Yeah.
So,
thank you.
Oh, yeah, you will be adding.
Yeah.
Really great information. I appreciate that.
And so, we printed off the regulations education and because of the local control aspect. I think it's about this big, and I made it through about halfway now.
Mm-hmm.
We're not seeing a whole lot of local control here, a lot of regulation control. So,
Yeah, and we're and if there are specific regulations that are costing you money and doing absolutely no good, and I'm sure they'll be so hard to find, you know, let us know, because we can do those on a different level versus on a statute. You know, we may have to go that level, but starting to kind of get that low-hanging fruit. We know there's some on the building structures and stuff like that we've heard from some of the superintendents and some of the others, but regulation is always a good place to start if there's ones out there that are just piling your paperwork but doing nothing for your school. We'd appreciate that as well.
I don't know what your schedule is. I don't know how long you're in town. If you have an opportunity to swing by the school tomorrow and see and walk through the construction project, you could see your dollars at work.
Marilyn was very fine less than a month ago or so.
Yes, very good.
We've been everywhere, man.
Right. And we're proud to say that we have some Fairbanks people working on that as well.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, we were fortunate to have been toured. We've toured every school.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
I'm glad.
And I don't remember where we met, but we've certainly met before.
I've been across your desk as in this role.
So, thank you for noticing.
And we will see you again.
Yes.
Yeah. So please, you know, keep that input going, because working like a business, I think, is really where I think it is. And it's one of the things that the legislature knows that we need to do something different. They just don't know what to do. They do know throwing more money at the same thing is not necessarily the answer. But how we do it is the answer. And quite frankly, what we've done is we have bundled education dollars, PERS and TERS, capital or the building, and then payment for rock stars like him. And they're all considered education dollars, and some of those are not necessarily.
That's right. The PERS and TERS on behalf is a difficult one.
And I'm real proud of what Kodiak is doing, because they're looking at how they can sustain their new buildings that they're building, and pay for hopefully the maintenance, but beyond that, they're looking at how can they pay for energy? How do we fast forward? Because if we can't keep funding at these high levels, how are we preparing in advance and doing our part? So Kodiak is doing a good job there. So
thank you.
And so is there anybody online right now? Okay, I just wanted to make sure. And it looks like we have one more contestant. So Marilyn, please step up to the chair. Your name for the record, please.
I'm Marilyn Davidson. I'm the assistant superintendent of
the school. This is who we've been talking about, in case people want to put together who we...
Our tour guide.
Our tour guide.
Okay. And we did spend a great deal of time, and as I shared information with both of the representatives earlier and appreciated that opportunity, you know, there are the scope of the work continues to change. And as we talk about sustainable funding, as we talk about a sustainable picture, when the scope of the work changes, when the scope of the challenges that we face change, when the scope of the needs of our students change, and we continue to want to gain that competitive edge for our students as they emerge from our systems, there's this sustainability and there's predictability that we have to balance. One of the things that we talked about when we visited earlier was this whole educator evaluation piece. And Jeff and Pat both alluded to that as they spoke about that. And I had told you that I was pretty excited about that, and I still am, because the evaluation piece as we head into it, we're only in the infancy of it. But I'm hearing professional conversations. We're having good interactions. I think teachers want that feedback because they do want to be really good at what they're doing. But there was an allusion today to this whole student learning data piece. And when we talked earlier, I didn't understand, and I'm only beginning to understand. So you guys haven't heard this yet, because I'm figuring this out in the context of this committee that I'm working with through the Department of Education and Early Development. But as we talk about costs, this is going to be an unanticipated cost for us, because it's not just the state testing that's going to be considered in this evaluation process. 2 to 4 indicators for every teacher will need to be identified. We will have to determine which students are being considered for each of these indicators. What will the indicators look like? What's the reliability of the indicators? What does this mean? When we talk about professional development, none of us, this is my evaluation as well, none of us can walk into this without sufficient training and understanding of what we're making a commitment to, what the expectation is. We're going to have more collaborative work between administrators and teachers, between my administrator and me, as we make these determinations. I'm thinking, and what I'm hearing recommended, is that this kind of process is going to require at least 3 conferences between a supervisor and a worker each year. It's news, isn't it?
Just for the record, this was not our idea. You know, and we're still learning about it at the same time because
and
we know it's very complicated.
And it was not our idea either. But this is another one of these surprising things that we're going to have to provide professional development. We're going to have to provide time. We're going to have a data system that's going to support this thing. We're going to have to identify appropriate assessments of all kinds for a physical education teacher like Pat, for a music teacher, for an art teacher, for a special education teacher. There are going to have to be different kinds of assessments for each of these teachers to identify this information, and then it would not be fair to say, and now we're going to set the target at the beginning of the year, and, oh, I'll talk to you at the end of the year. Not going to do that.
And
that
it starts,
wouldn't
and
be
it
right.
starts next year, correct?
We have 1 year beyond this to get this in place.
2015.
If we will report our first data on July 1, 2016. So my request for consideration would be that as we have this kind of timeline, as we have this kind of expectation looming before us, what do we want to do? We want to keep our eyes on the needs of those students that are served in our district every day. That's our job. That's our most important thing. That's the desired effect of the work that we do, that we make them successful. But we have to have the capacity to do this other thing that's also a requirement for us, too. Again, I'll echo my colleagues in saying I'm all for accountability, but we have to have the capacity to build the system to provide the accountability.
You know what would be very helpful for us? If you could send us how, you know, or you might already have there, how you evaluate, because I know every district evaluates their teachers. There's not a district that doesn't. How that is and approximately, and I know depending upon the teacher and everybody else, how long it takes compared to at this time, and I know that will change as you learn more about it, how long you think it's going to take to do the same thing for them. So we have that comparison because we have not delved down into it as far as probably you have.
And I'd be glad to provide that information, that whole evaluation piece, as we have known it and as it is growing in the professional aspects of it. That's one whole thing. This other piece with the data collection is an additional piece that is going to that's going to take on another whole aspect to the work. So as we talk about sustainable, there's the sustainable and there's the predictable. And I think I'd like to close with a quote, if I might.
Okay.
It's in my planner today. I love it when my planner comes up with a quote that's so applicable.
We're proud of it.
And this is from Edgar Fiedler. He says, "He who lives by the crystal ball soon learns to eat ground glass." It's not a real pretty picture, but I think it's an apt quote.
I think I need that planner.
And I don't think either one of us are going to try to tout that, but you know, we do want to say thank you for the graciousness of having us here and for the staff here, too, as well, to have us. We appreciate your comments. And, again, if there are people who are listening online or those that you go work with every day didn't have an opportunity to come, we would greatly appreciate to have. You know, it is to – it doesn't stop here. We've already told our colleagues, if you think we're going to write something that's going to take care of all the needs in this state, well, we don't want to, you know, get you all excited. It's not. But we have to start the steps. And know these steps have to be continued, not by task force after task force, but a continuation, an education plan for the state. So everybody's moving in the same direction consistently, and we can fix problems along the way instead of trying to do it on, like that when I said do it on the fly earlier. We've got to stop doing it on the fly. We have to do it like the others. And we are looking at the success, not just the successful states, but one reason we came to Kodiak to start with was better scores of Kodiak. And we visited those that are struggling, and we've tried to visit the schools that are doing great jobs and seeing if there's ways we could take what they're doing and being able to, because we do believe there's a lot of great things going on here. And we're just
really appreciative for everybody and everything you've done. So it's 6:05, and with that, thank you so much for taking your time.
And you're welcome to stay a little longer with any other ideas, but we'll be going off air now. Thank you.